Today is Monday, October 2nd, 2023. This is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Good.
Great. Peter, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Peter, I wanted to ask you some more questions about the Western Grand Canyon mapping. While you were doing that, what was Sue doing?
Well, what we were doing when we started the Grand Canyon mapping project, we were living on the South Rim. The park had given us an apartment there, and so she was living up there with me.
Had you finished your PhD by then?
I just finished
okay.
The PhD.
All right.
And so this was the summer and fall of 1970.
Okay.
And George Billingsley had a home in Flagstaff, so he would commute up, and that's how we did things. Now, of course, we were moving all over the Grand Canyon, north and south rim, and as long as we didn't have snow. So we would individually or collectively go out and work all over the place. So we weren't very confined to the South Rim, per se, except for me living there.
Okay.
But at any rate, Sue lived with me on the South Rim. And that was a bad situation for me because Sue had very severe asthma.
Ooh.
And she had an extreme attack there and simply died. So I lost her in the fall of 1970.
Oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that was a traumatic event, for sure.
And there was a hospital there, or had it been downsized to a clinic at the time?
It was a hospital.
Okay.
I got her to the hospital, but she just didn't make it.
Oh, my gosh, and she must have just had difficulty breathing then.
Yeah, she just couldn't breathe.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And I can only assume you must have been shattered. How did you survive?
Well, one thing that helped bring me through this was having a focus of working on the mapping project. And so that was a real positive in my recovery on that.
Okay.
And I simply focused on that and moved forward as best I could.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Is Sue buried at the South Rim Cemetery?
No, she's interred in Iowa.
Okay.
That's where she was from.
Okay. Wow, again, I'm just so sorry. So yeah, and I mean, did George help? Did you have any other friends for counsel?
George was very supportive, but we were simply working along on a project as best we could.
Okay. Okay.
Now, that was, at that point, we were just finishing up the Eastern Grand Canyon map.
Okay.
Or we were working on that, yeah. That was what we were doing.
Okay.
The Western Grand Canyon stuff came a little, you know, that came on its heels.
Okay, so we're finishing up the east side, and you've talked about a little bit of the western side, driving fuel over there. And I'm assuming you were based out of the South Rim, but to get to the west side, it's on the north side, not the south side.
Yeah, so we'd have to drive all the way over to Tuip and places like that. Or we were flying from the Grand Canyon Village.
Okay.
The thing that was really exciting about the Western Grand Canyon for us was that the Western Grand Canyon has active tectonics, where the faulting is actually occurring now. Every once in a while they have an earthquake out there. And the primary structures we were looking at that were active were the Hurricane Fault and also the Torweep Fault. And the Torweep Fault is often billed in geology as the most active fault in Arizona.
Really?
There's numerous little earthquakes out there. Anyway, both of those faults trend north-south through the Western Grand Canyon, with the Hurricane Fault defining the west edge of the Colorado Plateau and the mouth of the Grand Canyon going on out into the basin and range.
So Pete, let me ponder this, because when I think about the end of the Grand Canyon out at River Mouth 277, I think about the Grand Wash Cliffs out there.
Yeah, well, that's really the Grand Wash Fault is west of the Hurricane.
Okay.
And actually, I misspoke. The Grand Wash Fault is the western edge of the Colorado Plateau.
Okay.
And the Hurricane Fault is steps in about 15 or 20 miles in there.
And are all three of those active faults?
Well, the most active is the Torweep. The second most active in Arizona is the Hurricane.
Okay.
And the Grand Wash Fault is kind of not very active at all.
The
Hurricane Fault extends northward into Utah, and it becomes the range, just the main, the edge of the, what do I want to call it? It's the Wasatch Front. Salt Lake City.
Oh, wow.
So that's a really big, extensive fault. And it simply, as you follow it southward from Salt Lake City, it dies out in the Grand Canyon. The displacement diminishes until you get to Peach Springs, and then it dies out in a valley south of Peach Springs.
Okay, wow. That's and the Torweep Fault, is this a spreading center, or... What is happening to keep these faults active?
Well, what's going on is that the Colorado Plateau is a very stable shield on the west edge of the United States, and you have the Basin and Range out to the west. The Basin and Range is a spreading center where the rocks are being pulled apart, and there's great lateral extension, great east-west extension. Well, the Basin and Range tectonics, that east-west extension or pulling apart, is spreading into the Colorado Plateau, and these major faults that we're looking at are early stages as the western part of the Coconino Plateau and the Colorado Plateau get pulled apart. So they're active, and they represent this eastward encroachment of the Basin and Range into the Colorado Plateau. And we see that all the way to the West Kaibab Fault Zone and beyond, where the type of faulting we have is what we call extensional tectonics. It's where the rocks are being pulled apart laterally.
Okay, thank you. That explains a lot. Here in Flagstaff, we have what we call affectionately the bottomless pit, and that's on a fault complex that runs northeast a little bit, but there's a number of sinks, and this fault system is it can be 20-30 feet wide, and it's thousands of feet deep. Is that sort of the eastern extension of the Basin and Range?
Yeah, that's the same kind of extensional tectonics we're talking about. That's identical. There's a fault in Oak Creek Canyon that's associated with this.
Okay, all right.
And generally what happens on these faults, in general, is the west side is displaced down.
Okay.
So it steps down towards the Basin and Range. Now that stepping down is because as the crust stretches, the rocks sag downward.
Okay, that makes sense.
And we have these extensional basins. Cataract Basin is one of them. There's a big one at Blue Springs. That's the same kind of thing. They're riven with these faults, and the land surface just drops down, and it leaves you with a basin. Now, the thing that's so exciting, what was so exciting for us, was we got to map the these faults, and really for the first time in detail. And what I used to do is I looked at them on aerial photos, plot them as best we could, and then we'd field check them as we got a chance from either the river or from the air.
Cool.
But as I was working on these, I was up in Wyoming looking at stereo photos at the Hurricane Fault. And the Hurricane Fault, well, let me explain. The Torweep Fault is the easternmost of these faults in the Western Grand Canyon. Then you have the Hurricane, and then you have the Grand Wash Cliffs.
Okay.
I was mapping in the band between the Hurricane and the Torweep Faults. And I would do this in the evening, looking at stereo photos, and I would start making progress across the map. And, you know, you're talking about covering a few square inches a night on the map.
Wow.
And what was so neat was seeing the fault system unfold as we started to plot it on the map.
Oh, wow.
Because it was a very complex mess and very regular. It was really beautiful. And I think of the, we had three sheets, or four sheets that cover the Grand Canyon, the Eastern Grand Canyon map, and then three sheets to the west. And the middle of the western sheets is the Hurricane Fault Zone. And I think that's probably one of my most favorite maps that I ever worked on.
Oh, wow.
Was from that pattern. I think that's one of the neatest looking jobs that we ever did. So that was interesting. Now, to further this thing, like I say, the Torweep Fault is active, and so is the Hurricane. And you can see this because the younger the rock layers, the less they're displaced because the thing is recurring. And
hang on, wait. Can you explain that?
Oh, yeah. What happens is you got a fault.
Okay.
And it displaces some rock.
Okay. So one side goes up, one side goes down, or one
right.
side moves in one cardinal direction, and the other stays put, something like that. There's a displacement that's happening.
Yeah, and then another layer gets deposited across the region.
Okay.
And then the fault goes again.
Oh.
And that layer gets displaced. But, of course, the displacement on the youngest layer is less than on the older layer.
Okay.
So we get this record of recurrent movement by looking at the displacements between the different units that are offset by the fault and also the thickening and thinning of the units over the fault. And what's really fun in the case of the Hurricane and Torweep faults is that that activity has gone on, so it's offsetting the alluvium in the soil.
Oh, wow.
And at the Torweep fault, we have displaced alluvium. We have displaced volcanic rocks that have flowed over the alluvium. And we get to see that, and you can measure it. And at Vulcan's Throne, there's probably about 25 feet of displacement of the dirt.
Okay.
From the Torweep Fault.
That's like super young.
Yeah. And you know the Whitmore Trail.
Yes.
That goes up. You can hike up the Whitmore Trail, and there's a road that comes down
yeah.
to the top of that thing.
About a mile long. It's an easy stock trail.
Yeah, and what you can do is you can go up to that road, and just to the west of the road is where the fault goes through, and you can stand on one side or the other. You can just straddle it. It's fantastic.
Oh, wow.
And look down in the canyon to the south and see it going through the wool with the Paleozoics offset many hundreds of feet and the dirt offset by about 15 feet. That's really interesting stuff.
So when I think about the Torweep Fault, I think about this very young volcanics that, of course, make these lava flows that spill down into the canyon. And John Wesley Powell wrote about the combination of the fire and the water and, you know, what that must have been. Of course, living here in Flagstaff, we have a major volcano, like, you know, right out the backyard here. Is the volcanics that's happening in Flagstaff similar to the Torweep area with this spreading?
Well, there's a nice volcanic field out west of the Torweep Fault and at Flagstaff, and of course this is magma that's coming up, and you know, the people that worry about this think that part of the conduit system for the magma. And the Western Grand Canyon is probably up these fault zones because you're pulling the crust apart.
Wouldn't that would make sense, right?
Yeah, it does. And the Fulkenstrohne is right on the Torweep Fault itself.
Okay. So when I'm boating on the river and I go past what's called Vulcan's Anvil, which is an erosional remnant of basalt right in the middle of the Colorado River, to the right and left or south and north of that remnant, you can see the basalts going up the canyon wall up to the rim there.
Yeah, well, what they did is they flowed in the canyon and filled it up and put a big dam in there.
Right.
And that's very dynamic geology.
So is that basalt that I see, was that coming, did that go into this fault and fill it up, and then the canyon eroded it away, or was it from a lava dam that would have filled the canyon up, and with this hot material just flowed into this crack that ran up and down the side of the canyon?
Yeah, well, what happened is that most of it eroded, most of it erupted on the plateau surface.
Okay.
And so you had volcanoes up on a plateau surface,
right,
like Fulkenstrohne, but they were older.
Okay.
And that material flowed, the lava flows from those volcanoes flowed into the canyon and built these lava dams. And some of them look like they're, a couple of thousand feet high,
yeah,
before they burst and eroded away.
Right.
So the Colorado River ultimately eroded them down to where you see them today.
So when we see Vulcan's Anvil, it's this 50-foot high, maybe 50-foot diameter, you know better than I do the size of the thing, sort of tower coming up out of the Colorado River. Is that a remnant of a lava dam? Or is it a remnant of a volcanic vent coming up from below?
Well, that's an unanswered question. Every geologist that goes down there tries to figure that out.
Okay.
And most of them think it's probably a neck of a vent, but it could be a chunk of the lava dam.
Huh.
But yeah, that's a fun one. You just don't know because the water's covering up the critical outcrops, which is the base of the thing.
Okay, all right.
Here's this big block sitting right there in the river, and boy, the first thing you think of is that must be a throat of a volcano.
Right, but but there's a rock called Ten Mile Rock, which is up by Lee's Ferry, and it's a chunk of sandstone, I think Coconino sandstone, that it fell from up above, and it's been sitting in the river up and laying on its side, you can't go boat past the thing. Or 19-mile Boulder Narrows, there's a boulder in the middle of the river. It hasn't necessarily come up from the bottom, like Bedrock Rapid, where there's an erosional anchored remnant of the basement rocks in the middle of the river. So, yeah, you could argue it both ways.
Yeah, you just got to study them, They're out of place. If they're out of place, you just got to come up with a logical conclusion where they came from.
Well, since I've got you on the phone and we're talking about volcanics, then let's go back upstream a ways to not too far, maybe a mile or two or three below above the mouth of Havasu. There's a fault that crosses the canyon, and it's full of basalt. And
yeah, that's a little dike system that everybody looks at as they come down the river.
Yeah. And
that thing has been studied by Billingsley, has worked on that. And while he's working for the USGS, they've sampled some of the volcanics to try to get the age of them.
Okay.
And they've tried to figure that out. Now, the thing that's really interesting about that is that above Havasu, the inner gorge is about 2,000 feet deep.
Okay.
And that comprises everything from the top of the Red Wall Limestone down to the bottom.
Right.
And we see the dikes in the north and south walls as you float past there.
Right.
And they're exposed at river level all the way up to the top.
Yep.
And on the south side, if you get on top and you walk up on the Esplanade bench up there, what you find is a small cinder cone that's a vent from one of those dikes.
Oh.
And that was what Billingsley was looking at. Now, everybody has wondered, does that imply, because the cone is on the Esplanade,
right,
over 2,000 feet above the river,
yeah,
does that mean that the dike system predated the erosion of the Grand Canyon there? The magma came up the crack, erupted on the Esplanade surface, and then the canyon eroded down next to it.
Could be.
That's a good question.
Okay.
And then the other point of view is, as well, we see magma moving up through mountains and coming out the top all the time. They're just following the crack. And maybe if the side of the crack is exposed, the lava is freezing there and allowing the stuff in the interior to keep going up higher and higher.
Well, couldn't you argue that would work on one side of the canyon, but not the other, because you can see the basalt in the fault on both sides of the canyon there.
Yeah, now you're starting to think, and that's one of the conclusions that's made.
Okay. But now, it's funny because there are these little vents. There's a cute little vent just west of Havasu up Dry Beaver Creek. There's a cute little vent on the east side of Tuckup, in the east arm of Tuckup over there, not the huge basalt flow that's in the west side of Tuckup. So you have these weird little vents, or little volcanoes, if you will, cute little things, out in the middle of nowhere, if you will, sort of way over on the eastern side of the whole Toroi volcanic complex.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the important thing is to get the lavas dated, and then to try to put that into the picture of the erosion of the Grand Canyon and the rate of dissection.
Okay. So you've got this little stereo map, IMP maps, and you're looking at these in Wyoming, trying to figure out where the faults are going and what they're doing. And then you would go out in ground truth?
Yeah, then we'd go ground truth that. The easiest access we had out there was to fly it, because the land is so rugged, you'd spend months just getting around the place. So we had to do a lot of that with either a helicopter or a light plane.
Okay.
The ground truth. And then from the river, we could get, we could easily get a few miles back and forth along the river. And George did a lot of that field checking when he was working for Grand Canyon Expeditions. He'd go down there and just see how the map jibed with what he was looking at from the boat.
You mentioned the Whitmore Trail. If from the river you go up that trail, you end up on the east side of Whitmore Wash, and you need to cross that. If you go south from there, up on the Esplanade, there are these amazing, what I call basalt walls. They are maybe 4 feet high, maybe 3 foot high, maybe a couple of feet wide, and they sort of run overland as the Esplanade, the soft sandstone erodes quicker than the basalt does. You end up with these walls of basalt, which are actually just faults that are full of lava. I'm sure you've seen those.
Well, those are dikes.
Okay.
And those are vents. That's where the stuff is coming up.
Okay.
And you're just looking at erosional remnants of them.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll run for a quarter mile or a half mile. Fascinating little, you can walk along them. They sort of remind me of drip fences, except they're made of lava.
Yeah, that's right.
Just really.
If you went to Shiprock, New Mexico, you'd see them radiating around from the core of the plug that forms the volcanic neck there.
That's right.
And they stick out of the ground.
Yeah.
Of course, they're resistant.
Just like that. Just like that.
Right.
Okay.
Well, anyway, that was an exciting part of working out in the Western Grand Canyon, because that was far more dynamic than anything we found in the Eastern Grand Canyon in terms of active tectonics.
Well, okay.
Now there are earthquakes in the Eastern Grand Canyon, and they're primarily along the West Kaibab Fault Zone.
Okay.
And once in a while they feel one at Grand Canyon Village.
Hmm.
And we've mentioned Art Lang and Tom Ailey, the people from the Cave Research Association.
Right, Ray Desassure.
Yeah, they were in one of the big caves in the Red Wall during an earthquake.
Oh wow.
And they told me it sounded like a plane flying through.
Wow.
And of course, it kind of scared them because they're wondering if the cave has collapsed between them and the entrance.
Of course.
But of course, what you have to think of is the caves. Some of those caves are very, very old.
Okay.
We're talking about millions of years, and they've experienced many, many, many earthquakes, and they're still there. So, if you're in one and you have an earthquake, probably you're going to get out.
Okay, but still, not the place you want to be.
It's an unsettling. You know, earthquakes are unsettling because it's the unknown. You just don't know.
But I get your point that the Western Grand Canyon is way more active, certainly as far as volcanics and faulting with the major, as you say, you know, the Hurricane Fault is a major fault there, north-south. I had no idea it went up to the Wasatch.
Yeah, it goes all the way up to it goes up to the northern state line of Utah.
Wow, okay.
And then it gets lost underneath volcanics that are up in Idaho.
Okay.
Yeah, no, these are, that's the edge. It's a major boundary.
What else did you discover on the western side? What else do you recall about that?
Well, that was the most exciting thing.
Okay.
Another dynamic thing that we worried about were big landslides in the Grand Canyon. And the most well-known one is the Surprise Valley landslide that people hike past, where you can see the whole Red Wall Cliff has fallen down into old Colorado River channel and blocked it up.
Okay, hang on a second. Now, you did your master's in that area. At what point did you realize that there was a giant slump there?
Well, I could see the slump from day one.
Okay.
And I worried about that thing for the rest of my career. I always considered it to be the one piece of unfinished business that I had because I had never really figured out just what happened there. And the thing, it's very impressive. You have this huge wall of Red Wall limestone that has collapsed into this valley, and now the river runs south of there.
Yeah.
And it's dry, and you know, most of the critical outcrops are buried.
Hmm.
And every geologist that ever walked through there tries to explain it.
Okay.
And nobody got it right, and you can kind of tell. But anyway, what happened was Carl Carlstrom was working in there with a student, and Carl was looking at this thing. And he was sitting in Surprise Valley looking west, and what he saw was the north rim from which the north side of the canyon from which the slides had fallen was sitting there. He's got Cogswell Butte on the south side, and he's looking down the valley there.
Yep.
And he notices the valley is a nice U shape. And all of a sudden, he had this fabulous insight. That thing... the typical canyon in the Grand Canyon is V-shaped, and this is U-shaped. This starts to look like Uinoweap Canyon that goes over the Uncompahgre Plateau west of Grand Junction, which is an old Colorado River channel. And suddenly, Carlstrom says, hey, this may be an old Colorado River valley. What's going on here?
Okay.
The Colorado River is going through a canyon south of Cogswell Butte.
Yes.
And this thing is on the north side of Cogswell Butte.
Right.
The river moved. How did the river move? Well, then he starts looking behind him, and there's the Surprise Valley's landslide blocks there. And he says, huh, maybe the Surprise Valley landslide blocked a river, forming a lake that filled up the then Grand Canyon until it reached the crest of the dam, and then it spilled over. But the interesting thing is that it didn't spill over where the dam was in Surprise Valley. It spilled over a saddle on the south side of Cogswell Butte and simply eroded a new canyon there past Deer Creek.
Huh.
So that's that is the most viable explanation for this thing. And I think he hit it right on the nail. I think that's what we got there. Now, I've subsequently done a lot of work on that with him and independently. And what we find out is that the landslide block that slid into Surprise Valley that blocked the Colorado River obviously put a dam across the river. Now, the big deal is the height of that dam is 1,200 feet.
Ooh.
That's 1.5 times the height of Hoover Dam.
Okay.
This was a big thing. And that, you know, we're talking about real dynamic geology here.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that thing blocked the river, and the river went on the south side of Cogswell Butte and eroded the new canyon, and it left all that material behind. It's a lot of it's kind of covered, so it's tough to see.
Okay.
But once you start looking for it, you can find the bottom of the old Colorado Channel in the west wall of Deer Creek, and you can find it in Bonita Creek, which is a tributary just south of just west of Tabetz Creek, and all of a sudden you start putting elevations in, and everything comes out just beautifully.
So let me kind of ponder this. I can see I have a deep incised canyon, and then I have a land slump, and that land slump basically fills the canyon up, and sort of in the middle of the slump is a huge dam, and in the middle of this dam is Cogswell Butte sort of sticking up.
Well, Cogswell Butte is the south wall, the abutment of the dam. Yeah, now you got the canyon. You got the canyon is eroded between the valley is the south wall of the canyon is Cogswell Butte, and the north wall is the north side of Surprise Valley. Okay.
Okay.
That's the U.
Okay.
And then the north side of Surprise Valley collapses into this U-shaped valley and fills it up to a level of 1,200 feet. And Cogswell Butte just sits there passively.
Right.
So what happened is the Esplanade and all that stuff on the north side of the canyon collapses in.
Yep.
And it flows into this valley, and the Esplanade sandstone, which is about 300 feet thick, is riding on top of this debris that's collapsing into the canyon, and it simply slides across the canyon and docks against the Cogswell Butte and forms the crest of the dam there. So if you hike from Thunder River over to Deer Creek, you have to go over a saddle.
Right.
And that is the Esplanade crest of the dam that you're walking over as you drop into Deer Creek.
Okay.
And it's out of place. That Esplanade is displaced down several hundred feet from where it originated.
Right.
North. So it's a very dynamic, interesting thing.
Very, very much so.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Cool. And so, you know, there are other landslide areas. I think of the Red Slide just upstream of Vulcan, of Lava Falls area. There's a, you know, the whole, all the Penitentes that are up in there. That's a small slide kind of area. And think of other, of course, at Nankoweap, off of the, what, is that a slide that was off of the east wall that put all that huge debris hill there, and then that was eroded away along the east wall.
Yeah, one of the most dynamic ideas for the stuff up by Nankwe is that river is going north-south through there. The canyon wall goes all the way from river level to the top of the Kaibab limestone on the east wall. So you got almost, 4,500 feet of relief there.
It's impressive.
Yeah, it's impressive. And then you have Nankwe coming out from the west and intersecting the river.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, the best idea is a huge block of the east wall fell off, crashed down into the canyon, hit the river, and kept right on going up Nankwe.
Okay.
And piled debris on the west side of the river.
Okay.
So the blocks that you're seeing there originated from the east side, but they rode up the west side.
Makes sense.
And are sitting down there
yeah.
in Nankwe, in the delta at Nankwe. And that's a pretty young event.
So these things must happen in 100,000 years. What sort of frequency are we looking at here?
Well, we don't know. We know that they're happening.
Mm-hmm.
And when they happen, they're fast.
yes.
These are dynamic.
Hmm.
You don't want to be around them. And once we started mapping these things, I got the hot idea that I ought to be selling insurance to these river runners. These things would, if one of them came down, it'd be bad news.
Yes. Well, it would be a game changer for a while.
Have you ever heard of the Hebgen Slide that occurred on a Snake River in western Wyoming?
No.
Well, what happened was there was a big mountain that was sitting next to the Snake River on the south side, and the side of the mountain came off.
Okay.
And it slid down into the river.
All right. It slid
down towards the river going north. And when it got to the bottom of the canyon, there was so much momentum, the material rode up the north side at an elevation of at least 600 or so feet above
wow.
the bottom of the thing. And when it went through there, it buried a camp full of Boy Scouts. At
the time. Gosh.
But at any rate, it rode up. And that's a classic landslide situation. You got so much momentum, the material actually moves up the opposite slope when it falls into a canyon.
Okay.
We have the same thing down at Deer Creek.
Hmm.
The north wall fell off west of Deer Creek,
okay.
went down into the river, and went right up the south side, and it's still there, easily exposed. And the first guy that figured that one out was Don Elston from the U.S. Geological Survey, and then a fellow named John Warmy got in there, and he worked on that. But anyway, the run-up on the south wall is hundreds of feet.
Okay.
And you can't believe what a mess that is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And there's
anyway, that's the Western Grand Canyon. Anyway, the Western Grand Canyon is very dynamic compared to the Eastern Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
And so from a geologic perspective, we really enjoy it. But the problem is the Western Grand Canyon is also the most rugged part of the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
The access is terrible,
huh.
and everybody suffers from the heat out there because the place
yeah.
is the hottest part of the canyon.
Yeah, yeah. It's a winter place to go explore.
Yeah, right.
Not summer. I have one more interesting sort of landslide question for you. Have you ever walked on top of the Shinumu quartzite from? There's a little riffle just above Neville's Rapid, or 75 Mile, and you can get out of the boats there and walk the top of the Shinumu quartzite contact, going downstream on River Wright, and it kind of angles up pretty steeply there, and then the river turns to the west and heads down past Papago to Hance, and right at that corner there is a fairly substantial half acre or so, or more, of land that has separated with a 4-foot gap from the main complex to the north. Have you seen that? I mean, there. I'm just thinking about. All right, I'm not talking about a Deer Creek size failure, but something smaller. I mean, bigger than a boulder falling off a cliff, where there's an actual potential for the next fairly large dynamic slide to occur in Grand Canyon.
Yeah, it sounds like that's a typical type of small scale detachment that you get. And it sounds like that one's a rather slow-moving jobby that's in the process of going now.
Yeah, it's just slowly.
That's like a lot of creep you see around subdivisions around Salt Lake City where the landslides aren't necessarily catastrophic, sudden events. They're slow-moving.
Okay.
And you get every degree between.
And then, what was it, 2 years ago... there was a fairly good rockfall off the Kaibab that rained down on fence fault. And then the USGS had a little stage station there that blew that out and just peppered the ground for acres with a couple inches of dust and small rock.
Yeah. Wouldn't you like to be down there when that happened?
No, I'd have died. Quickly. But yeah, to be a quarter mile away with a camera would have been stunning. but these things happen. I mean, it's a dynamic place.
Well, I had a very interesting experience. I was down there above Havasu, probably above the ledges, and there was a group of three of us, four of us, my wife and I, and another couple, and we were running late. And we couldn't get down to the ledges to set up a camp. So we just pulled off on River Wright, which, as you remember down there, what that consists of is big blocks of limestone with sand in between them.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know that. And what we did is we found little places to pitch a couple of tents, and we were very content there.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what was interesting is I was with this couple. And, you get to know people by the time you get that far into the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And she had expressed one of the greatest fears she ever had from the time she was a little girl, and that was to be under a rockfall.
Oh.
I don't know why that was in her mind, but anyway, that was her...
Well, she's in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Why wouldn't she be terrified about a rockfall?
So anyway, we're camped out there. At about 4 a.m, it just starts to rain like the dickens.
Oh.
We get a huge storm coming in there, a thunderstorm. And by about 6 o'clock, we're out of the tents looking at this waterfalls coming off both sides of the canyon. It was absolutely fantastic. And one of the things that got me and my wife out of the tent was one of these waterfalls came right down the cliff between our tent and the wall, which was only a separation of a couple of feet, and it was starting to wash our tent into the river.
Oops.
So we were out. So anyway, here we got these waterfalls, these 2,000-foot-high waterfalls, and we're really really in awe of this stuff. But in the meantime, the tent's all wet, the sleeping bags are all wet. So what we do is we hang out there for the rest of the morning drying this stuff out. Well, about 11 o'clock, the bags were just about dry. I had a kitchen table set up so we could have some lunch,
mm-hmm.
and that table was about 4 or 5 feet from the edge of the cliff that dropped down. And all of a sudden, I heard what sounded like a stick of dynamite going off, and I looked up, and the ledge above us, 2,000 feet, was coming off the red wall.
Ooh.
Right on the camp. And the four of us were there. My wife and I ran up the river. The other couple ran down the river. And the rocks came right into the camp. And if you can imagine the table sitting there, one of the slabs was about 4 feet by 2 feet by 8 inches thick. That came right down next to the table and peeled the paint off the edge of the boards.
Wow.
And that's how close it was. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, the woman who was fearful of these landslides,
yeah.
She was running down through these boulders of Moab trying to get away from the place, and she saw this beautiful slab of Moab laying against the cliff with a little teepee-shaped hole underneath.
Yeah.
And she just dove for that because that looked like safety. Well, she missed and hit her arm on the block and cracked it.
Oh.
So we had, that's the only casualty I've ever had in the Grand Canyon. But anyway, she cracked it, so we had to deal with that for the rest of the trip. But I found it so ironic that that was her anxiety, and she got to live it.
Wow. Well, there's no place safe there when you're in that kind of rain or a rockfall event. Where can you go? Your options to get away are pretty limited.
Well, we were just lucky, you know. It's just another lucky shot. Everybody gets lucky once in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd rather have that than to be where some of these flash floods have come out and caught camps. Boy, I'll tell you.
So, can you tell me a little bit more about how you got into river running? I know you mentioned last time that you bought some Avons, two Avons. You built your frames, and how did you get permits at that time?
Well, at that time, we were able to get permits very easily because the Grand Canyon had administrative allotments, and some of those allotments were given for science.
Okay.
So now this is under the Longren, or Lovgren, whatever his name was.
Lovgren, yeah, Bob Lovgren.
They just gave them to us. I just made a phone call, and we were on the river within 5 days.
Oh my!
It was as simple as that. Now later on, they got a little more strict with them, but by the time we were finished in the Eastern Grand Canyon, and in the Western Grand Canyon, that's when they really started to tighten things up. Well, we were done, so we didn't have to deal with much of that.
And it suddenly occurred to me that when Bob Lovgren left, the next superintendent in that was there for any amount of time was a fellow named Merle Stitt.
Yeah, I didn't interact with him.
Okay.
Yeah, if I was interacting with anybody, it would have been their science liaison, his name was Dave Ochsner.
Okay.
And he would make these arrangements for us.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Yeah, it was very straightforward.
And then who did you boat with? Did you have some friends that you'd boat with that liked geology and would like to stop and get out and climb around?
Well, the main types that I used were just regular boatmen that wanted a trip through the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
What I always had difficulty with was finding crews that would go. I was at Wyoming. I was at the University of Wyoming at the time, and everybody wanted to go on a river trip when we talked about them in the fall, but by the time you were ready to pull out with the boats in the spring, everybody had bailed on you. So I had a heck of a time finding bodies to get out there and man these boats.
What did you do?
Well, in some cases, of course, I had graduate students who were working on theses down there, and we'd take them along. They were excellent.
Okay.
But otherwise, I was just picking up people virtually off the street on this thing.
Okay.
There was one case that was really funny. It was really odd. I was sitting in my office, and I was trying to pull off a trip, and I couldn't find anybody. And this was in the spring of one year. And there was this guy that was wandering around the halls in the geology building. And I thought he was a student. And he was looking at all the, and we had some pictures of the river hanging on the wall, and he was looking at that stuff. He was a young guy, and after a little while, he started talking to me, you know. And here I am trying to pull this trip together.
Hmm.
Well, finally, I said to him, well, hey, you want to get down the river? Well, the guy was all enthusiastic, so he said, yeah. So we loaded him into the truck, and off we went. And it wasn't until two or three days later that I found out that he was just passing through town and was interested in geology, was wandering around a geology building, and here he got us a river trip out of the deal.
And did he take that on to further a geological career?
No, he was just a guy off the street.
Huh, that was just kind of curious and got a river trip and then carried on.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, that happened. Oh, I had to. The couple I was telling about that were involved in that rock fall, they were friends of a boater that I met on, what was it? It was the Dolores River.
Okay.
I met these guys, and so I had names of some boaters, and they were in Colorado.
Okay.
Well, anyway, I'm trying to put a trip together, can't find anybody, so I call him up, and I say, hey, Rusty, I need a couple of people to go down the river. He gave me a couple of names, and that was the couple that I was dealing with there.
Oh, my gosh.
They weren't geologists. They were just boaters.
People that wanted a boat.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'll tell you, I'm grateful for them. But it's ironic, because you would think that people would fight to go down the Grand Canyon, but I had a heck of a time putting crews together.
Huh, if they had only known. Gee whiz. So you mentioned the Dolores.
Yeah, right.
When did you run the Dolores?
Well, that would have been early. That would have been in the early 70s. Once I got the rafts, we were trying to do rivers all over the, in the Colorado system.
Okay.
So I got in at Dolores. And I was very lucky on at Dolores. I went down there, and this guy, Rusty, that I met, and I actually first ran into him when we went through Cataract.
Okay.
And we met him down at Dark Canyon.
Okay.
We were going down the river, and we pulled off at Dark Canyon. They were already parked there. There was no other camps, and we landed on top of them, and we had a great evening together.
Okay.
Well, anyway, he was sitting there at Dark Canyon with a bunch of boaters, and all those folks wanted to get off the river and go home, and he wanted to go over to Dolores.
Oh.
So he was in the same boat I was. He couldn't find anybody to go with him. So he looks at me and he says, hey, you want to go run Dolores next week? We're leaving tomorrow. I said, yeah. So I got on the Dolores with him.
And this would have been before McPhee.
Huh?
This was before McPhee Dam.
Yeah. We got there before the dam. And what was really great was we were there early in the spring. Well, the trip starts up in the pine trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got up there. I think we took out at Slick Rock.
Okay.
But at any rate, so we did the whole thing. We did all the good stuff. But the thing was in flood. It was fantastic.
Oh, wow.
So we put on up there in the pine trees, and the water was in the pine trees. We were having a problem finding the channel.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. So, that was the best way to see the Dolores. The Dolores was really cooking that trip. And I made a couple of trips down there. But that would have been the early 70s. That was just those were vacation trips.
Well, you must have been looking at the geology as you floated along. And what did you see?
Well, it's pretty straightforward up there. It's just flatline Mesozoic rocks. So it wasn't that terribly exciting. But, we got to see a little geology there.
But beautiful country.
Oh, it's fantastic. The Dolores is a great run.
Okay. What was your boating record like? Did you ever turn a boat upside down?
Oh, of course.
How did you do that?
Well, I screwed up, obviously. Well, it just happens,
Uh-huh.
I've had two or three flips.
Okay.
One was in Crystal. We talked about that.
Right.
That was a really amazing flip, and the thing that really impressed me, I think I mentioned this. Every time I flipped a boat or been on a boat that flipped, I landed in the water underneath the boat. I never was thrown clear.
Hmm.
And that got old, but at least you knew you were going to live, and we got out.
Yeah, but you're in the footwell, and there's air in there, but you got to get out of there. You're like,
I'll tell you, my most humorous flip story was we were going down through Cataract,
okay.
Got to the big drops, and there was a we were in there in pretty good water.
Okay,
I'm trying to think. Maybe something like 20,000, something like that. 20,000 CFS.
All right.
So the big drops were cooking pretty well,
mm-hmm.
And I had this Avon Spirit, and uh, I made a left run through the Big Drops, which is the classic run at that stage.
Okay.
And I dropped over, and there's a V-wave at the bottom. And I got caught on a V-wave. It turned the raft sideways, and the thing just gently turned over and landed on top of me.
Oh.
And then we swum out to the north bank. And it was absolutely frozen in my mind, the whole thing. And I got this Avon Spirit, see, this row rig. A year or two later, I got invited to come down and go on a park trip where they wanted to have a geologist along to tell them what was going
okay.
on.
All right.
So I went on that trip. And we had a whole bunch of boats. And the Park Service had the identical Avon that I had.
Oh, well.
And they have this a young woman, who was the oarsman on the boat.
Uh-huh.
And so I jumped into that boat, and I was with this woman from the Canyonlands Natural History Association named Ellie Inskip, and she got in with me. And so we're riding down the river with this park ranger, and we get to the Big Drops. That woman made the exact same run that I did.
Oh, no.
And we went over the lip. And as we were going over the lip, I see that V-wave down there. And I turned to Ellie and I said, "Hey, Ellie, we're going over." We hit that V-wave. It was just a perfect repeat. We were upside down in the river. And that evening, she comes up to me, "How the heck did you know we were going over?" Yeah, the river is fickle.
Been there, done that.
but the thing about the river
is,
generally it's very forgiving. It scares you, but it doesn't try to kill you.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Most of the people that flip live.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
Well, that's
And it's practice. I mean, I just love it that the Park Service spends so much time practicing, swift water rescue, and here's what happens when you flip your boat. Okay, let's practice that. It's just lovely training, so when it happens real time, you just go out and put things back together and carry on.
Well, that's the way it is. I never did any practicing. I just ran them. I didn't worry about it.
Ellen Inskip. Now, there's an interesting name. What else do you remember about Ellen back in the day?
Well, she was, at the time, the head of the Canyonlands Natural History Association. So she was handling the sales of the maps that we were that we turned out up there.
Okay.
Yeah, and I got to know her. She was a very interesting, nice character,
mm-hmm.
and just was she was in love with the place.
Yeah.
Made a home in Moab and lived there.
Did you ever meet a river ranger named Patricia Gredigan?
No, never did.
Okay.
Never heard the name even.
All right. And this would have been in the 70s that you were in Canyonlands?
Yeah, yeah.
She was probably in the 80s, so that's why that worked out that way. Okay. All right. At one point, I'm going to want to ask you about Canyonlands. We've been going about an hour, so maybe this is a good place to put in a comma in this interview series, and the next time we'll pick up on Canyonlands.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. In the material that we've just covered, is there anything in here that you want to add in?
Oh, no, we've done enough.
Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. Then with that, this will conclude Part 7, the Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Monday. It's October 2nd, 2023. And Peter, thank you so very much.
Okay.